This is the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
So, Tom, tonight we're going to just have a conversation with you and me. How does that sound?
That sounds nice. Let's do it.
You've been a regular panelist. You've been with us from the beginning, right? I think you haven't missed much of anything.
Yeah, I don't know if I've missed very much. I guess I'm a loser.
And you've taken the ground of oftentimes being the faithful defender. Sometimes when George hasn't been around, you've been the lone voice in the wilderness.
Yeah, well, somebody's got to defend the church, and I think at times it definitely deserves to be defended, for sure.
That's true. So there's probably an interesting story that we want to get to as to how you ended up here on the Mormon Expression podcast and how all that happened. I mean, we've had pointed out to us several times that we don't have a staff of a lot of, orthodox Mormons, and that's probably because of that we're willing to, you know, talk about these issues. And a lot of, I think, the more orthodox people just don't want to be recorded on the internet talking about this sort of stuff.
Well, yeah, and they don't want to associate with heathens or even people that are a little less orthodox.
So, tell us maybe about your background. You grew up in the church?
Yep, born and raised in the church. Pioneer ancestry on both sides. I even did the whole youth thing, you know, scouts, what were they called? Those youth conferences. I went to those.
The ones at BYU?
No, not at BYU. I mean, the ones.
Sorry, I didn't mean to imply anything there.
No, the youth conferences. Are you very familiar with the youth conferences?
Yeah, we had youth conferences in the summer. You know, we'd all get together and throw watermelons and whatever else we did as kids.
I remember one youth conference, and this was like a big multi-stake one, and we all got together, and I ended up getting thrown out of my comfort zone big time. Nobody in my ward, nobody I even knew, and I had to camp with these parents that I had never met before, and I was with these five or six other kids, and we did all these games, you know, like you stand on the stump, you fall backwards, we'll all catch you. It's a trust thing. And we also did, there was that huge spiritual moment, you know, where they like, okay, go up into the hills and there's a letter that your parents wrote, you know, how proud they are of you. Read the letter and then you're supposed to write a letter and you're supposed to spend time praying and meditating, did all that big time spiritual experience, you know, and then they have a testimony meeting. Yeah.
Yeah. I went to the same one.
Yeah, I probably saw you there.
So you went on a mission?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, went on a mission. I went to this. It was on a stateside mission, and no foreign languages for me.
Where'd you serve?
I served in the Midwest. Yeah, where there's a lot of church history.
Oh, that's
but,
kind of fun.
There's an interesting story. You want me to share it?
Sure.
All right. Kind of leading up to all this stuff. I mean, there's been a lot of questions and doubts in my lifetime, you know. And I even remember writing down, because I kept a journal for about the first year before my mission, because I was trying to get my life straight and stuff. So I start writing in a journal, and in my journal I even write some of my doubts, thinking, you know, am I doing the right thing, and is this all worth it? Is there really a God? Is, you know, stuff like that. But I remember, how old are you when you get a patriarchal blessing? Like 16, 17, somewhere around there?
Yeah, I think that's about when I got it, 17.
So I got my patriarchal blessing. And in my patriarchal blessing, it states that I will serve a foreign mission. And I will receive the gift of tongues to learn a foreign language. So when I got called to the States and to keep doing the good old English, I remember thinking, what? I mean, that was a very direct promised blessing in my patriarchal blessing. And I thought, that's odd. I think that was odd. I was like, that's very, very strange. So for me, when I started to, I like the analogy of having a shelf where you put your questions and your doubts. So I'd started to build a shelf and, that was the biggest item on my shelf was, okay, one of the biggest promised blessings that I got, didn't come to pass. And I even remember on my mission, asking my mission president about it, saying, this is awfully strange, don't you think? I mean, who's more spiritual than a patriarch, right?
Yeah.
So that was one of the biggest items on my shelf at that time.
Yeah, that's interesting, you know, because a lot of people, when it comes right down to it, what keeps them grounded to the church is personal religious experience, those sort of personal kind of transcendental experiences they have. And it's interesting that for you, it's kind of the same thing, but that was your chief doubt. It's that personal experience as opposed to anything, you know, huge doctrinal issue, at least at that point.
Yeah, at that point, I mean, I didn't have any major doctrinal issues. I thought that was kind of my first little red flag, like something seems off. Anyway, so I go on my mission. I mean, I'm the oldest of my family, so I remember thinking, so it was kind of a 50-50 thing, deciding to go on a mission. I remember thinking, okay, you know, I want to go, but I do have some questions and things that I'm like, I'm not so sure I should go, or I really want to go for myself or for the Lord, but I'm the oldest. And I remember several people saying, you know, the decisions you make in your life will determine more than just yourself. You know, you're an example. People look up to you. You know, a lot of people are love and respect you. So your decisions don't just affect you. And that kind of pressure always played on me. So, so I decided to do the right thing. And when I finally decided that I was going to go on a mission, I remember thinking, you know, I think that I'm doing it for myself, but I think it was more like a 60-40 thing.
I think that's pretty typical.
Yeah, so, I mean, I served an honorable mission. I didn't have a lot of success, but our mission averaged about 5 to 10 baptisms a month. I have lots of funny missionary stories. You know, I had the crazy companions, and I was in the leadership in the mission. I mean, fairly typical, I think.
All right, so you came home, and you went back to school?
Yep, I went back to school and got a job, and within a year, okay, so I got home around April or May,
mm-hmm.
And then that January, I started to date who is my wife now. So we started dating in January, got engaged in February, and got married in May.
Oh, so you could have been on our podcast with the lightning fast marriers.
Yeah, I guess that we definitely qualified for that. So yeah, we married in Salt Lake Temple. And it's, you know, she was going to school at the time too. And so we both were going to school, both working and doing the broke student thing and living in some cheap apartment in Provo. And that's how that was going.
So living in, did you go to BYU then?
No, Utah Valley, all the way.
Okay.
It was UBSC at the time, but it's Utah Valley University now. So
what's the next big milestone on your faith journey?
Okay, so a lot of unnecessary stuff. I mean, I get married, and then 2 or 3 years later, we have our first child. And I mean, everything's going fine. I mean, we're faithful. I constantly, I'm going in and out of different callings, and we moved a couple times, but that didn't change anything. And we had a few other kids. I mean, I have 3 kids now. So, let's fast forward to 2007? Because 2007 is when everything changes for me. Well, let's go a year before that or so. I was in a fairly prominent leadership position in the church in my ward, and I started having some additional questions about certain things. Most of it was I didn't like the way the welfare program works in the church. I didn't like that the ward can pay for people's mortgages and rent, especially when I thought that they were abusing it and not using it for what it should be. There were some other issues that I put on my shelf, but I did a pretty good job at ignoring my shelf, I thought. Even when I was on my mission, I added things to my shelf, you know. That's when I first learned about Joseph Smith's polygamy and polyandry. Didn't really bother me at the time. Anti-Mormon lies, you know?
Yeah.
So let's go to 2007. In 2007, there was a movie called September Dawn. And it was getting all publicized. And the key moment that I seem to recall the most was I was watching the local news, and this local anchor lady, she's in this room, and she's like, "You guys have heard about this September Dawn movie, right? About the Mountain Meadows Massacre." And they're all like, "Yeah, they're all professional church historians. There's 10 of them in the room." And she's like, "Okay, so who in this room, of all 10 of you, believe that Brigham Young ordered the massacre?" And only 2 of the 10 raise their hand. And then she says, "Okay, who in here thinks that Brigham Young was in direct involvement of the cover-up afterwards?" And 8 of the 10 raise their hands. And I was just standing there. I was completely dumbfounded. I'd never heard of the movie. I think I had heard about Mountain Meadows Massacre in passing, but never understood what it was. So I was like, that's stinking wild. Does that mean that our prophet, Brigham Young, might have been involved in murder? Anyway, so I started thinking about that, and I got online and watched the trailer for the movie. I mean, the movies. Have you seen the movie, John?
I haven't seen it because it was panned. But maybe I'll put it on my Netflix queue or something.
I mean, it's not a great movie, but there's one scene that I think is really great. I think their reenactment of the actual event of the massacre is phenomenal. But you know, for that purpose, I think it's worthy of watching, but other than that, it's pretty poor. Anyway, all that aside, so I went to the local library, and I checked out 3 or 4 books on the massacre. I got Juanita Brooks's book. I got John D. Lee's Mormonism Exposed, I believe.
Right.
And one other book that I never did get to, because I spent my entire time with Juanita Brooks's book come to find out.
So. Likely it was The Blood of the Prophets.
No, I didn't read that one originally. I read Juanita Brooks's book. I only read through parts of John D. Lee's book.
John D. Lee's is kind of hard to slog through, but everybody should read Brooks's book. You can get through it. It's concise. It's clear.
Oh, yeah. It's phenomenal. I mean, when I was reading it, it was like I was, you know, in college again, and I'm taking notes, checking on footnotes and stuff like that. I was a maniac.
And she remained faithful her whole life.
Yeah, she did get threatened quite a bit.
That she did.
But yeah, I made it through the book. That was a very, very distressing and emotional time for me. Because it felt like I'd never experienced anything like that before. It seemed new, seemed fresh. All these wounds started appearing, and they were very sore. Anyway, so I went online and did some more searching of credible books or other information I could find on it. That's when I got Bagley's book, Blood of the Prophets. I bought that book, still have it. That's a great book, by the way. So then I did a bunch of other research, but I put that item on the shelf for about close to 8 to 9 months. I was on a fairly prominent stake leadership position at that point. Eventually, I got involved in apologetics because I felt like they had the best answers to a lot of the questions on my shelf. Yep. I got involved with them.
You got involved with them online?
More than just online. I mean, I joined.
You went to the conferences?
I didn't go to the conferences, but I paid their membership fee. I got in their email group.
Okay.
And so, you start getting bombarded with all their questions. All the people that submit questions to the apologetics would come into my email box. I mean, I would average from 50 to 80 emails a day.
So did that uncover a lot of like unsavory elements that you were unaware of or unacquainted with from before?
Some. I mean, it's hard. There were some subjects that I wasn't very familiar with that did get brought up in apologetics, and I felt like it was kind of my responsibility to start becoming educated if I was going to try or attempt to answer some of these people's questions. So I started doing some additional research. At this time, mind you, I was doing my very best to stay away from anything anti. I mean, Will Bagley's book, I know, is kind of on the edge. Some people consider it bad news.
Right.
But that's about as far as I went as far as critical books. Anyway, so I tried to stay as best I could in the positive things, got Rough Stone rolling and all that stuff. But, yeah, there were some issues that I wasn't aware of. I mean, the history of homosexuality in the church, that was new to me.
Mm-hmm.
How they were treated and stuff like that. But
so do you think overall your time with the apologist was a net benefit to your faith or a detriment or just a wash?
It was some of both. Apologetics. Oh. I'm mixed about it. I think it did. I mean, if you were to ask my wife, she said it was the worst decision of my life. But to me, I thought it was great because it opened the floodgates for me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then because I was in my frenzied studied mode. I mean, since when that Mountain Meadows Massacre thing hit, I mean, I was reading books like a bookaholic all of a sudden. I couldn't get enough. I started going in all different directions, you know? I started learning as much as I possibly could about church history. And yeah, I even delved into trying to answer some questions for some people that were trying to find answers through apologetics. So I stayed in apologetics for almost a year, and that's when everything went south and sour for me. I couldn't hack it anymore. I had kind of a mental breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it was kind of like my peak. Finally, it felt like my shelf was just couldn't handle the weight anymore, and it just crashed. And I couldn't handle it anymore. So I went to my stake president, asked to be released, and, you know, threatened resignation. Took my wife in there. Kind of got treated fairly poorly.
Well, see, you went so far as to actually, you were contemplating leaving the church then.
Oh, I had a resignation letter typed up, yeah. Yeah, it was a ugly time. And I ended up putting all my thoughts together, all my research together, because at that point I felt like people need to know this stuff.
Right.
You know, this is stuff that I didn't know, and it felt like, you know, I kind of switched back into missionary mode. Like, people don't know this. People need to know. I felt like so I put all my research together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's anywhere from 40 to 50 pages long, I think.
You know, it's funny. I have the same thing. As I went through, and I wanted people to understand, especially my family, to be able to understand where I came from, and I have that half written. I've never finished it. I don't know if I ever will. It's at 75 pages right now with 30 pages of footnotes that I wrote, but it's never gone anywhere.
Well, mine did, sort of. I mean, I kind of made it a condensed version, and I emailed it to as many people as I thought would listen. Printed it out for a few people, and that was a big mistake.
I can imagine.
I gave it to my wife and kind of pressed her to read it, and she read through some of my friends read through some, my parents read through some, everybody, it was a nightmare. Everybody freaked out, you know, and I felt like that guy on top of that tall building, you know, and I'd cut open the pillowcase and was spreading out the feathers everywhere, and
right,
just watching them go everywhere, and then all of a sudden I realized that that was a huge mistake, and so I kind of things went real ugly, you know. My marriage started to strain. My relationship with my family went terribly south. Some of my friendships just dissolved. I kind of got on an island, and I even went to therapy for a while. Everything just went nasty. And the worst part was, is, you know, everything was crashing around me in my head and my emotions, and I didn't know where I was going. Anyway, several months later, a good friend of mine that's in the ward, he came to me, and he was a stud. Also, my bishop at the time and his wife, they were wonderful. They reached out to me. I started to make things right with my wife. And so the decision was made that I was going to go back to church. So I went back to church, accepted a calling, and I've pretty much been back. I've been going ever since.
So how long were you, did you remain inactive?
Probably about 3-4 months.
Okay.
Not very long. But it certainly seemed very, very, very long. That was hell. That time was pretty bad.
Yeah, the experience. The experience you describe is, I mean, it's one I've heard described 100 times. And, you know, you're going through this emotional state yourself and reaching out for whatever you can. And then you try to reach out to your family by giving them this letter, you know, explaining this stuff. So now they're dealing with two things. They're dealing with you and trying to contextualize your position as it's slipping the church. And then all these issues that are suddenly being kind of forced on them in a way. And it's a very difficult time for everybody, because the person in the middle, the person who's suffering through it, is just grasping, and there's hardly anything to grasp onto. Luckily, with the internet today, there's places they can go, but, you know, there's a lot of things that aren't healthy out there on the internet that you can grab onto also.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's why this is, to me, it's so important, because this is heavy stuff. This is life-changing events. It was probably one of the toughest times of my entire life. I will definitely say that. It was hard.
Oh, I agree 100% from my own experience and my family's experience, and then others that I've known. It's indescribably hard for people who haven't lived through it. You're going down this path that you're compelled down, but you just can't stop once the genie's out of the bottle. It's not like you can just put it back. Once that faith balloon pops, you know, you have to find something to replace that with. And it's not, you know, a lot of people think you can just start paying your tithing, go back to church, but it's this internal turmoil that you're dealing with. You're finding all these facts and you're mourning the loss of all this stuff at the same time. It's very traumatic.
Oh, I was desperate. You know, I wanted to talk to anyone, someone, and nobody wanted to talk. Nobody. And yeah, luckily there was an online community that I kind of went to for a little while. I reached out to Bob McHugh. Bob McHugh, if you're out there listening, I can't tell you enough how much that meant, that you reached out to me and talked to me on the phone a couple times. That was awesome. Even John DeLynn, you know, I reached out to him. He was great. The few people that I could reach out to, I was reaching out to anybody that would listen. And it was weird, because the people in my ward and the people that I really thought that I loved and trusted and served with and all this stuff, it was amazing to me to see them quickly turn their back on me. It was devastating. I mean, emotionally devastating for me. I didn't expect that. Because I kept imagining that they would embrace me and immediately, you know, do the love bomb thing, you know, like, can we do anything for you? Would you like to talk? No, it wasn't anything like that. It was the opposite. I was totally ostracized. It was.
Yeah. I've read some experiences people say online where they get love bombed, or, you know, the people are coming in their face and confronting them. But for my wife and I, our experience was akin to yours. It was, we suddenly had the plague. And that made us all the more alone, and there was nobody to talk to. And so I understand completely what you went through. We went through the same thing. And if anything, my continual participation on the online communities and in things like Mormon Expression is because of that loneliness and isolation that I felt, that if there's any way we can help others through it, not saying to end up on one side or on the other, but just to get through that long dark night of the soul, that's what I'm interested in.
Well, and one of the turning points for me is I remember being so scared to talk to a guy like Bob McHugh, because, I mean, he's considered an anti-Mormon in a lot of people's views, for
right.
sure.
Mm-hmm.
And when I reached out to him and he reached back and I talked to him on the phone, I mean, I was amazed at how kind he was and how thoughtful he was. And he's like, if you can make it work with the church, do it. You know, if you can't, fine. He's like, and he gave me a lot of wonderful advice that I took. Look, he told me that I should try therapy, and I did. And that was a good decision, I think. And I was mostly just amazed that he was not who I thought he was. I hate to even admit this, but I thought that he was going to be an a-hole, you know, because anti-Mormons are that way.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was genuine and kind and only had my best interest at heart, it was amazing. I even told my bishop that after, you know, he calls me in months later, and I was like, you know, just to let you know, these people who you think are anti-Mormons, there's some of them that are actually good, honest people that only have our best interest at heart. That was a huge turning point for me, because I was stuck in that mindset, you know, thinking that all these guys that are critical of the church, they're bad, they're evil. You don't want to talk to them because they're only bring you down.
So how long has it been since you've come back to church now?
Well, I went back to church in 08, late spring, I think. And I kind of had an off and on through that summer, but I've been extremely active since. So probably in the fall, I started attending very regularly and accepted another calling, and that's where I'm at now. I actually have two callings. I'm in between. I mean, I got extended a call, and they just haven't sustained me yet.
Uh-huh.
But, and so that's where I'm at. I'm very active.
So is it getting better?
Yeah, it is, actually. There's times that, you know, I kind of have to distract myself a little bit, but there's other times that I actually enjoy it. It was tough to go back at first because a lot of people didn't know how to handle me, you know, because a lot of rumors had gone out, and a lot of people kind of knew what was happening and what was going on with me. And, I mean, I was shunned for a while, but the truth was, I wasn't going back for them. I was going back to save my marriage. I was going back to save my family, the people that I would die for, you know? To me, going back to church to make that work is unnecessary, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just as you're talking, the metaphor that comes to mind is the one you hear in the church all the time, the refiner's fire. That, you know, you had passed through an experience that was very, you know, emotionally trying, and, you know, with your marriage and your family, you'd come out on the other side and in a lot of ways come out victorious. And I think even in the way you've been in these podcasts, the way you're talking now, you can see that that's lent maturity to what you have to say.
Are you saying I'm mature? My wife and myself would both disagree with that, I think.
Well, you know, I think these experiences that those of us who go through faith crises, that it's in a way kind of like going through combat or something. It leaves you with something. Some of that's positive, some of it's negative. There's a lot to be learned about, you know, human nature and empathy. One thing I know of that in the hundreds of ex-Mormons that I've met in the years that I've been around is I think there's a higher level of compassion and empathy when it comes to those sort of emotional problems, which is probably one of the reasons there's a strong affinity between, say, ex-Mormons and homosexuals, because the kind of experience they go through is somewhat akin. It's related. And don't get me wrong, there's still a lot of ex-Mormons who are just as big of jerks as they were before, but I do think that there's something to be learned from that experience, both positive and negative.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I learned that I didn't really fully understand, or at least I didn't think, I thought I understood it, but I obviously did not, was the insane desire for people to want to be understood.
Yes.
I wanted to be understood so badly that it literally drove me insane. I mean, I remember in some of the therapy sessions, I remember thinking, I just want to be understood. People don't understand me. People think that I'm making stuff up. Some people think that I'm running to alcohol or whatever. That's not the case at all. And they won't even take that step to even try to understand because, you know, as weird as it sounds that, yeah, Mormons have that defensive mechanism. They just don't want to talk about this kind of stuff because they see guys like me and what I went through and they don't want to go through that. I don't even want to, you know, avoid the very appearance of evil, right?
Right. So what are your favorite aspects of church today?
Oh, there's a lot. I love the social aspects of it. I love that it's laid back. Well, at least some wards are. You know, my ward's pretty laid back. I like the participation. Let's see. I liked the fact that you can be involved, you know, that you can accept callings and have responsibility and feel like you're part of something. And even with podcast number 3, when we talked about our favorite things about the church, there's certain doctrines that I actually deeply resonate with. So yeah, there's a lot of things that I really, 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 truly love about the church.
How do you go about managing your doubts today? What's kind of your mechanism for doing that?
That's a good question.
Do you still have the shelf or is there another metaphor?
I don't think, I guess I do have a shelf still. I mean, there's still some questions that I'll never fully understand. You know, like, do I personally believe that Brigham Young ordered that Mountain Meadows massacre? I don't know. And there's no way to ever fully know. I have my own opinion about it, but I mean, I still have a shelf. It's got a lot less items on it though. Yeah. But the way I deal with my doubts at church, I guess I just kind of go with the flow. I love to talk about Mormonism. I love the richness of it. And it does get frustrating when it's the recycled, superficial stuff that they constantly talk about. Pray, read your scriptures, you know, go to church. But, you know, when you really get talking to people, I mean, I'm really not any different than most of the people that go to church. It's just, I've taken that scary step, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, it sounds to me in a lot of ways, you've been able to separate the, you know, the daily act of going to church and doing that from the historical, you know, Mountain Meadows and Brigham Young and all that stuff.
Well, yeah, at times. I mean, I still listen to conference like a junkie. Like I told Niall, I love it. I pay attention to what the church says more now than ever. And I really don't have a good explanation for that. Just that, you know, something stirs me in the soul with Mormonism. I love it. I definitely have my qualms and my questions that I'd certainly like to sit down with the general authority, even though I don't think it would get anywhere. But there's certain things that I'd just like to be able to say and maybe to listen to what answers they'd have for me. But I think I still respect the brethren. I think that they're trying to do the best they possibly can. So I don't want to sound too much like John DeLynn, but I resonate with his position. Because there is a lot in the church that shouldn't be ignored. You know, you don't want to, it's that same old cliche, you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. So,
yeah, I agree. So what would you advise for other people who find themselves in your situation? Especially the situation you were in, say, 2 years ago.
Don't give up and find your own path. And most certainly and definitely don't feel like, if you feel like you're alone, you know, get online or something. You know, we're out here. I'm amazed at how many, I even surprise myself sometimes that I'm just constantly reaching out to those people that seem to be struggling. You know, you every once in a while online on a board of something, you'll get that one panicked post, you know?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. It's just kind of a reflex, you know, I'll send them a personal message. Hey, here's my email, here's my phone number. If you ever need to talk, if you ever need anything, please feel free. Or if you're ever down in my area, call me and we'll go have lunch. And I've had some of those experiences and it's great. I remember when I was talking to Bob McHugh and he told me, because I remember saying, you know, I really appreciate you taking the time for me. And I know that you've probably done this with lots and lots of people. And he's like, I just do this because I hope that you can just return the favor to somebody else. And that resonates with me, you know, because he reached out to me. So I kind of feel like it's my responsibility to reach out to others.
So what do you think the church can do to better respond to individuals like you?
I don't know. I would like to think that the church could, but I've thought a lot about this. I don't know how they can. I mean, because we're wolves in sheep's clothing, sort of. You know, but
I think we're more sheep in wolves' clothing.
Here's the thing. Yeah. Here's the thing that I want to make sure that I clarify. I mean, I'm not a disbeliever in any sense. I'm not a guy that goes there and raises my hand in Sunday school and say, oh, no, you've got that all wrong. I'm not that guy. I rarely participate in classes anymore because, you know, I've got my own thoughts and they're just not appropriate situation.
When you say you rarely participate, you go, you just don't speak up, right?
Yeah, I don't speak up. I don't raise my hand when they say any questions. My mind's like, yeah, but I just keep my hand down. So I respect other people and their beliefs. And there are certain things in the church that I long for. I mean, it's like in one of the podcasts, I don't remember which one, when I said that in the temple recommend questions, I can answer those as honestly as I feel like I can. And still, you know, depending on the bishopric member, but as of now, they've all, welcomed me in. And when I give my answers that I feel are honest answers, as close to as honest as I can be, they still, allow me to participate and be part of the ward. And that means a lot to me. So.
Well, it's been great having you on the panel. I think you bring a good, solid voice and, you can give the smackdown on Niall when he needs it.
Anybody can do that. But yeah, thanks for the compliment.
All right, Tom. Well, it's been great having a chat with you.
Thanks. I've enjoyed it. I really appreciate you willing to do this podcast and especially including me.
So I think it's been a lot of fun. And I think the best is yet to come.
Definitely.
If you'd like to contact Tom, you can email him at tom@mormonexpression.com, or you can email the panel at mail@mormonexpression.com. Remember to check the website, mormonexpression.com, for further discussion and information on the podcast that you're hearing. Also, remember to call 801-906-6722 and leave us your comment, complaint, or suggestion. Our music is provided by Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com.
You really did?
Uh-huh, yeah.